It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, a museum without walls where artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversation. Today's really spooky conversation is going to focus on the science behind monster legends, real-life diseases or disorders that may have spawned or even fueled monster legends. With us, we have two really not spooky scientists, but scientists who may be able to give us a little bit of insight. First, I've got Dr. Bill Sullivan, who's the Showalter Professor of Pharmacology and Toxicology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Sorry. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Mark. Good to see you.
You too. And I've got Dr. Randy Cross, who's a neurologist, the medical director with VCA Advanced Veterinary Care Center. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Mark.
Good to see you both. I know both of you have been really busy with all the things that are happening around the world, but this is our time to kind of look back and say, where did we think some things that people were scared about may have come from? And there's enough scary in the real world to be afraid of. However, this one's kind of fun because we can look at some of our legends. So kind of to start us off, one of the things I know on other shows I've talked to you about, Bill, and that is there are origins for why things like werewolves or vampires may have come about. So why don't we start there, and that might give us a good point to go, and then we can go wherever you want.
Sure, and you're right about that. You know, we're looking back in time, you know, so we don't have a crystal ball on these things, but scientists and researchers have come up with a number of hypotheses that are rather convincing in how they might account for some of the monster legends that people are familiar with. A lot of the usual Halloween monsters that we see roaming around the neighborhoods this time of year. So before we get into that topic, I'll just let people know who don't know that monster is a term that's derived from a Latin word that means warning. So it's basically some sort of individual or a phenomenon that creates concern, induces fear, because the unknown is unpredictable. And that's what the brain doesn't favor. You know, the brain favors patterns, reliability, and predictions, because that increases chances of survival. But when unknown variables are thrown into the equation, when there is someone who is behaving erratically, or looks very strange, or just is out of the ordinary for some reason, our brain goes to this rather dark assumption place where it labels these things as unpredictable, potentially dangerous. And it usually takes that conservative route. And there's a lot of phenomenon in the world that you were alluding to, Mark, that may have initiated or more likely fueled various monster legends. One of the ones you brought up were vampires, for example. So there's actually been a scientific paper published back in the 90s where the investigator drew four major parallels between vampirism and the rabies virus, okay? So most people are familiar, and Randy can probably elaborate on this as a veterinarian in much greater detail, but most people are familiar with the rabies inducing aggression and violence in people and other animals and causing them to bite and spread the virus that way. So where's these parallels to vampirism? Well, the four things boil down to biting. We have biting going on in both the vampires, spreading its contagion according to some legends. Whoever gets bitten becomes a vampire as well. Same thing happens with rabies. The second commonality is something called hydrophobia, which is a fear of water. So most people are familiar with the fact that vampires hate holy water. Okay, they have that strong fear response. But most people don't know that rabies induces a fear of water as well. It, my understanding is that it paralyzes the throat muscles, so you really can't swallow. And despite the fact that the victim wants water very badly, can't really have it and gets frustrated. The third parallel is heightened sexuality. This happens in both rabies victims. It's connected to the aggression, and it's also an element of vampirism as well. You know, the very handsome Dracula luring in his female victims and so forth. And then finally, there's the bat connection. Vampires can transform into bats and get around that way. And rabies utilizes the bat as a vehicle of transmission. So there's four parallels for you between vampirism and a real world infectious agent.
Wow. And so Randy, I know, you know, one of the things that when I take my animals in that we get shots for are rabies. And I know that it can be really serious in an animal if they get it. Are there strong parallels in animals in the way they act, even with their brain, when they get some of these things?
Yeah, the first thought I had when you were talking about fear of water, I don't know if you all are Seinfeld fans, but there's a famous episode where they keep talking about symptoms of rabies, and Kramer tells Elaine that one of them is fear of water, and she starts suddenly having trouble swallowing and starts gurgling water, and it's falling out of her mouth. So for Seinfeld fans out there, that's a famous episode I remember. we do see the furious. There's a furious and dumb form. We kind of classify most animals, domesticated animals that we see with rabies, as a furious or a dumb form, which is the furious is the aggressive attack, unprovoked, regardless of consequences. See that probably more in wildlife, foxes or other animals that really without regard start attacking unprovoked. That is a common problem that we see in wildlife. And then the dumb form is where patients just become, moribund. They sit there, they lie there, they don't do anything. That's probably not as common. And largely, Mark, as you said, because we vaccinate for it, for domesticated animals, it's largely a minimal risk in veterinary medicine in these days. We do get cases. I think the last case in Indiana, where we are, in a domesticated animal was 20, 30 years ago, a while ago. But the reality is we see this in wildlife all the time still. So it is still very much a prevalent disease in this country. And as Bill said, it's not the most common in bats, but when transmission occurs in this country, it's usually because of a bat to a person, that is. So it's most common in a lot of raccoons and skunks and other species. But when we worry about people, this is actually a huge risk when we see people that have a bat in their house and people ask them whether they've been bit or not. It's actually a very common thing because it's a high prevalence. And that's not not a usual behavior. Going back into the monster thing, anything that deviates from normal behavior, like rabies, that would cause a patient, or in this case, an animal, to go into a house or do something that they wouldn't attack when they wouldn't be somewhere they wouldn't, could certainly be involved. So,
So that hijacking the brain, sort of what Bill was saying in humans, it's happening with the animals in a way too. They're probably fear is heightened, they have no fear at all, go beyond it to in the aggression state, or they become passive. But there's something going on when they get that virus that is changing their behavior from what we would normally see.
Yeah, dramatically. And so whenever we have, neurological signs, it's always on our radar, especially if we have certain clinical signs, difficulty with moving their jaw, aggressive behavior towards their, family or somebody else. As I said, luckily in veterinary medicine, in companion animal medicine, we've largely reduced this risk. The vaccination works tremendously well for prevention, which is why for people, if they are exposed, they get vaccinated, you know, very quickly post-exposure, it can actually help even in those circumstances. There's been rare circumstances where someone has survived rabies, but there's been a couple that have existed.
What other kinds of monsters, Bill and Randy, do we have?
Well, if we're speaking about mind control, which is a fascinating subject, I don't think scientists have figured out how rabies or other infectious agents manipulate the brain or cause these changes in people's behavior. You can, in some ways, some of these infectious microbes seem to understand our brain better than we currently do because they can make us do things that facilitate their transmission. You know, so rabies, for example, is transmitted through the saliva. There's a high concentration of viral particles in the saliva. So it makes sense that it would evolve a mechanism to co-opt the brain to make the animal or person much more ferocious and aggressive so that they would tend to bite and therefore spread the virus. So there's a number of infectious agents that get around that way and manipulate the brain in ways we don't quite understand. But it's good for neuroscientists to study them because it can shed light on our basic neurobiology. But probably the monster that comes to mind most when you're talking about mind control is the zombie phenomenon. And rabies has been implicated in that sort of genre as well. But there are, you know, real world zombies, so to speak, in terms of where this religion originated. And we have to go back in time to the slave trade in Haiti. This is where the zombie legend was first characterized and studied by anthropologists from Harvard called Wade Davis. He heard about the voodoo religion of Haiti, which involves zombies. And he went to study this. And based on some of his findings, there's basically what happens is a bokor, which is kind of like a priest, a key figure in this religion, who would victimize someone by blowing zombie dust into their face. And this zombie dust knocked the person out. Many believed the person had died. They would even be put into a shallow grave or put into a crypt. But then by the next day, they would be alive again. And the people of this religion thought they literally came back from life. They had been resurrected and they are under the Bokor's command and have to do whatever the Bokor says, you know, for the rest of their lives, or else their soul will be destroyed because, you know, the Bokor demonstrated his power over them. So this is a form of mind manipulation. But Wade Davis really wanted to figure out if there was a biological mechanism underlying all of this. And he found something very interesting when he studied samples of zombie dust that he procured from various bokors when he visited Haiti. And there's a wide variety of things in it, but there's a lot of potent neurotoxins, paralytic agents. And one that he honed in on was an ingredient from the puffer fish. It's a neurotoxin that's prevalent in the puffer fish. And it's why it's a dangerous fish to consume, because it can lead to paralysis. And if you ingest enough, it can actually lead to death. So Wade Davis hypothesized that these bokors figured out just the right dose of these neurotoxins, these paralytic agents, to administer to people to knock them out for about 24 hours. But then as the drug wears off, they come back to life. Unbeknownst to them that it was a drug that was doing this. And the religion is it has such a strong influence on the people that when they do come to, they really adhere to what the Bokor says because they honestly believe the Bokor now has power over them.
I feel sorry for the initial test subjects that were like, I got to test this dose out. It's like, can you come here? I got to try this.
Yeah, the
Bokor, oh, that was way too much.
Yeah, the Bokor probably had to learn from, again, you know, from apprenticing with another Bokor to figure out that. And I'm sure they were looking at size and weight and other things that we would look at in a more primitive way, but I'm sure they got it down pretty well. And then you tap into the culture with it. And I think that's the culture is a really interesting thing. But are there examples where something really does actually take over the mind?
Oh, absolutely. There's no shortage of examples in the natural world of parasites taking over the mind. And it's like runs through every strata of life conceivable, from the lowly ants all the way up to humans. So one of the most famous I'll tell you about real quick is, it literally has zombie in the name. It's called the zombie ant fungus. And these poor ants who pick up these fungal spores, they're doomed to become zombies. The fungal spores will take over their neurobiology and hijack the ant's brain. And we talked about how rabies makes a brain cause the animal to be more ferocious. The zombie ant fungus causes the ant to do strange behaviors as well. It doesn't get more violent or aggressive, but it leaves the colony and it kind of goes off on its own, climbs up onto a plant and gets on the underside of it, and then just clamps its jaws down right there, like in the middle of this leaf on the underside, and just stays there. Meanwhile, the fungus is growing throughout the ant's body and eventually takes over, and a stalk shoots out of the ant's back and rains spores down onto the forest floor where all of his ant friends are crawling, therefore spreading the fungus around to other ants. So it's a rather dramatic and very unsettling way. I mean, it's just ripe for horror movies that a very simple organism with no brain, no nervous system, a fungal spore, has managed over the course of evolution to hijack an ant's brain and use its body as a vector to spread itself to other ants.
So I would assume that, Randy and Bill, that the goal of that particular, I guess we'd call it, a being of some sort or living thing that is the parasite, its goal is to just exist, right? It's going to figure out any way it can to go on and reproduce and keep going.
And yeah, I mean, I would hesitate and use, I know exactly what you're saying with goal. I don't think there's an intent and purpose in any of these things to do so, but okay. Evolutionarily, when something does have a means of transmission that gives it an advantage, therefore it succeeds. So it's not the intent and purpose of this organism to do so, but the genetic variations that predispose it to climb up the stalk, rain fungal organisms are going to allow it to propagate in a much better fashion. The animal who exhibits aggressive behavior like rabies bites, transmits. So when that variation and mutation occurred, it's going to be more successful. Not the intent of the organism. Not the intent, because when we usually think about intent, we think of higher class organisms who have consciousness and actually will in doing so. But a lot of these organisms we're talking about, we don't attribute to that. They're just more successful when their mutation leads them to transmission.
Good clarification on that. And I agree with you. That's really a great thing about the genetic part of how what continues and what doesn't, and they've evolved over time to be able to continue. Yeah, and it's a tendency, and that's what part of this conversation is about. It's a tendency, just as I did, for us as humans to make it human-like. In other words, make diseases and things that, like Randy, I'm sure in your practice all the time, we're putting human qualities on animals that don't exist. That they're mad or they're, do you see that in your practice?
Yeah, I mean, we anthropomorphize lots of conditions, and rightfully so. I mean, some of the structures are similar And the brain of dogs and cats are most commonly domesticated animals we talk about. But I mean, obviously there are more, you know, exotic avians and reptiles that we interact with. But, you know, there are similarities in the structures of the brain that would make us believe that they have some level of consciousness or interactive. And we name diseases after, you know, having some kind of actual aggression. So you have rage syndrome, terrier rage syndrome, not to pick on that breed in particular, and we see it in other ones, but, you know, we have these conditions where we actually think that they're, you know, having some form of exaggerated behavioral response, and what that is caused by, we don't know. But certainly there are conditions where that is a fact where we, you know, attribute it to having some level of consciousness. So, and reaction, because when we talk about behavioral issues, we even give them obsessive compulsive behaviors in addition to other things that they might exhibit.
Mm. Really, someone needs to do a genome-wide association study on those breeds to try to pinpoint genetic loci that might be associated with those behavioral changes. They've done that in humans, you know, trying to identify genes that are associated with greater aggression and violence.
You can then begin to see, and you both were talking about it, you begin to see where people began to take on this idea of monsters, because that fear response, even in animals, is really big. And so I would assume, Randy, we don't know because they can't tell us, but they can become afraid of a specific incident or another creature or even their human companion, you know, in much the same way. That fear response is there, and then they exhibit behaviors in response.
Well, you read a lot of the, you know, books on behavior, evolution, and everything else, and you quickly see that we're more wired to predict or suspect something's afoul than we are to ignore it, mainly because, and the classic example is you're walking, you know, in a field and you hear a noise, you're more likely to ignore it. Next thing you know, you're tiger, you know, food. Whereas if you are more apt to respond to stimuli and things like that and assume, so we are very wired to create, you know, myths, legends, you know, stories about what's occurring than we are to just ignore things. So it's a heightened sense of, you know, reality in some ways.
Wow. Those are all interesting. We're talking to Bill Sullivan and Randy Cross about the science behind monster legends. Please join us for more conversation after this break.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week, we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation about how real-life diseases in humans and animals may have spawned or fueled monster legends with both Bill Sullivan and Randy Cross. And earlier we talked about zombies, and I know, Bill and Randy, that in your world, there's some interesting zombies that affect cat. Talk about that.
Yeah, what you're talking about there, Mark, is the parasite called Toxoplasma gondii. And it's actually the one we study in my laboratory at IU School of Medicine, because it's a fascinating organism and it affects humans as well as just about every other animal on the planet. So it's very widespread, which is unusual for most parasites. So Toxoplasma takes on added relevance because most people aren't aware of this, but approximately 30% of all people in the world carry this parasite in their brain right now, and they don't even know about it. And it raises the question, what might it be doing? Well, there's been a lot of studies in animals that are suggestive that having this parasite in the brain might have some disturbing effects. So let me back up a little bit and tell you about Toxoplasma. First of all, it's a single-celled parasite, and people can catch this parasite from taking care of their cats. When cats are infected they expel the parasite oocysts, which are kind of like the eggs of the parasite in their stool. So the parasite eggs can be sitting in the litter box or a sandbox or a garden or somebody's yard. And those parasite eggs are stable in the environment for up to a year, maybe two. And they can be ingested or inhaled accidentally. And from that, a person or any other animal can become infected with toxoplasma. Now, the parasite is very stealthy, doesn't make people very ill unless they're immune compromised at the get-go. So it basically gives very minor symptoms, if any symptoms at all, and then just goes up to the brain and then lives there for the rest of the person's life. And for decades, for the longest time, scientists and doctors thought that this was not a problem because these people weren't showing any symptoms whatsoever unless they become immune compromised. And then the parasite can become life-threatening. And that happened a lot in the 80s when HIV and AIDS patients didn't have the drugs that can fight that virus right now. So toxoplasma does some amazing things going back to the cat that you've mentioned. And in the cat's part of the life cycle. So most people are aware that mice, rats have a real innate aversion, fear of cats for good reason. Cats are one of their major predators. Now, toxoplasma gets into rodents just as it does people. But scientists have found that when their laboratory mice are infected with toxoplasma, these mice start behaving very strangely. They're definitely not normal anymore, even though they don't have any obvious signs of illness. You know, their fur's not ruffled, they're not losing weight, they look pretty happy, but they do some strange things. And the strangest two things that they do is they move around a lot more. They seem to be like hypermodal, hyper anxious. But the second big thing is they lose their fear. They're not afraid of things anymore. And that includes cats and cat odor. So this is where the story gets really interesting, because being a major predator, the cat is going to eat mice and rats that are fearless, which is what toxoplasma does to their brain in ways we don't understand yet. But the reason why may be because the cat is where the parasite ultimately wants to go. The cat is the only organism on the planet that we know of where the parasite can undergo the sexual stage of its life cycle. That happens in the gut of the cat, and that's why an infected cat will secrete parasite eggs in their stool, because it's the what we call the definitive host of the organism. So toxoplasma has this really complex life cycle that has managed to manipulate the brain of the mammal in ways that make it more anxious, more mobile, and less afraid. And people always wonder, so if toxoplasma can do that to a rodent, what does it do to a human's brain? And the truth is we don't fully know that yet. There's been correlations that toxoplasma might heighten the risk of schizophrenia and other neuropsychoses like rage disorder and anxiety, but there's no causative science behind it. So that's how toxoplasma zombifies rodents. But I wouldn't quite say that they do that to people just yet.
Wow. Randy, do you see that in cats?
Yeah, it's a very, very common disease that we see in cats and that we talk about even for dogs. Again, the predominant species that I usually treat, but all kinds of protozoal organisms, you know, the classification for where they come from, these organisms are fairly ubiquitous in our domestic animals. And toxoplasma can cause a variety of clinical signs beyond just neurological. For cats, we see it with gastrointestinal, we see respiratory problems, we see all kinds of different issues. And when we specifically talk about neurological cases, we see them there's certain parts of the nervous system that seem to have a predilection, the toxoplasma. The other organism we see very frequently is Neospora, another organism that frequently for dogs. But we definitely see it common enough that whenever we have cats and we have this syndrome, we actually warn people, because if you have never been exposed, if you've been exposed before to the organism, you have antibodies, and it's not as a great of risk for women who get pregnant, but it's common enough that, you know, if we have women who are pregnant and they've never been exposed, and then they're exposed to toxoplasma while they are pregnant, it can cause a whole host of developmental problems. So it's very frequently that we talk about it in veterinary medicine and warn, you know, to be expecting mothers about it. But yeah, I was just diagnosed a cat this week with toxoplasma that had neurological signs. So again, we test for it very frequently. It's probably one of the more common infectious tests that we run.
Yeah, and these things, just like other things, people are familiar with the increase in Giardia, and those, they live in the ground, or they get into pools of water, or they live in the feces of an animal, and then they move to the environment. That makes me think of the cross between then, that humans have kind of been fascinated with, and I am, that between having an animal, part animal, or part of the time an animal, part of the time a human. That gets me to that thing that I started with, it's werewolves. So where in the world did that idea of fascination, I guess werewolves are part of it, but there's been other things of where people turn, they're part something and part something else.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, Mark. And we don't have any definitive answers about that. But in trying to speak to the science behind some of the monster legends, there is a very unusual condition that's quite rare, but it would be extremely memorable and certainly would be worth writing tales about and spreading around the rumor mill. So if it did happen, it probably spread like wildfire. So there's a rare genetic disorder called CHL. It stands for congenital hypertrichosis lanuginosa. And basically what this does, it's a genetic mutation that causes hair to grow all over the body, even in places where it normally doesn't grow, like the forehead and the cheeks. So if this had happened in the past, you can imagine that people would certainly remember it. It's also hereditary, so it runs in families. And you know, there's nothing, it's worth stressing that there's nothing abnormal about these individuals at all. There's no behavior associated with a werewolf. That's part of the legend. But you can you can Google pictures of people who have had this condition, including the famous bearded lady, which most people are familiar with from the 1800s, Julia Pastrana, I believe her name is. They look like a werewolf just because of all of this excessive hair. So you can also imagine back in the day when rabies was much more common, if someone who had this CHL and then caught rabies, they would then embody the full spectrum of what we consider to be werewolf legend, not only looking, like a wolf, having all that excessive hair, but even acting more animalistic and violent because of the rabies. So that's pure speculation, but it's a tantalizing hypothesis.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because I could see also there's a cultural and a behavioral thing of the way people treat that person. And so if they're really afraid of them, they might, ostracize them. They might take on aggressive behaviors, not just in self-preservation, not what we're talking about otherwise, but just to keep themselves safe, right? People might try to kill them because they're abnormal in the people's eyes.
That is one of the most tragic aspects to monsters. When people label other human beings as monsters, simply because they look or act in a way we don't currently understand. The real monster is fear. And we just need to get to the biological underpinnings of what is causing these issues without ostracizing or excommunicating, or in the case of like the Salem witch trials, burning witches because a woman acted so, you know, with bizarre behavior. When today we probably know that was a neurological disorder that could be fixed with treatment. So you're absolutely right. This is the tragic component to creating monsters in our mind.
Wow. Randy, dude, are there things that you see in your practice that would be where the humans feel like their animal has become a monster in some way?
Well, I think the most common scenario are, you know, any syndrome that takes the animal out of its right mind and it displays a sudden difference in behavior. I mean, the most common example of this would be a seizure and resulting in a patient suddenly acting aggressive towards the owner. Very frequent in dogs, especially not so much during the seizure, but after the seizure. And there are conditions too that we associated with that we think that are in dogs. I don't know how well we've flushed it out, but sundowner syndrome, where patients, you know, suddenly, you know, have very different behavior towards the end of the day, and whether they're a form of a seizure or just a behavioral disorder. But yeah, when you, and, you know, taking off what Bill just said, that once you disrupt the natural relationship of a person to person, person to their dog or cat or even stranger, but once you disrupt that and you've broken trust and broken bond, then you then start getting the behaviors that can result in people not wanting their dog or cat, or people distancing themselves from other people, or out groups and in groups. So whenever you start getting behavior that does not fit what you consider normal, then you start to, you know, distance yourself from that. So so those seizures actually can be quite traumatic in the relationship with, you know, the people who all want to help their animal, but at the same time, they're very fearful of what that animal might do, you know, when they're not necessarily in their right mind.
Yeah, because we have that ability as, you know, within our mind to create a legend, or a living legend at the moment, a narrative that sure. Often can be the worst case scenario. We can yeah. See something that's really bad. You know, this brings up a topic that I think is really important too, and you've both been hinting at it, but something with genetics and that. And I know that humans were beginning to wrestle with the idea of designing humans, but we've been designing dogs for a while, and not always to the best. And so what happens in breeding, that what are some of the problems that we can get into when we start to breed to get something else, in a particular animal?
Yeah, there's definitely a whole host of disorders that we continue to perpetuate. One of the classic examples that we believe is the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, a wonderful temperament of a dog. If you've never interacted with them, just such sweet, loving dogs. But they are so ubiquitous in the presence of a malformation called a Chiari malformation that's often associated with a syrinx. So essentially, the back part of the skull is small, and it pushes down on the brain, and it creates fluid buildup in the neck, among other things. And so this is so ubiquitous that we would suspect that we're breeding their facial for them to look a certain way, which is probably also contributing to that. Again, that's a little bit of speculation, but certainly in that breed, we're, you know, doing that. I think the most famous example I can think of is reading Dr. Della Hunta, who recently just passed away, considered one of the godfathers of veterinary neurology. In his book, he talked about inbreeding so much in a certain line of cat that somehow it ended up with a cloaca. And he said, cats don't have cloacas. And it was like, okay, that's definitely true. I remember reading that study and for boards. But yeah, I mean, we genetics, it all started, you know, for dogs. You know, you would breed and you'd have dogs around you that exhibited the right temperament to interact with you. dogs follow our hands and our eyesight, you know, very well, which is one of the classic reasons why dogs have become so, you know, evolutionarily tied to humans, because they can do this. And when you breed and you do those things that they can read humans' cues better and better, and they have the right temperament, then that has led to why we can have dogs, such wide variety of domestication.
So there's this range in there, I mean, of stuff we really don't know. I mean, we sequence genomes and that, but they're huge. And we really don't know. So when I'm a breeder, I may be trying to do the right thing, but I'm only looking at a certain set of factors that are actually manifesting themselves and missing that there could be things that are in there that are not good, that to be passed on and on and on through it. So I go for one or two things. So it's almost like I am looking at a certain prize that I want and missing all the other things that potentially that might be an issue with it. And I'm not saying breeders are bad in doing that. That's how we've gotten to where we have the animals. But we do get into some extreme breeding where people want, you know, in, at the facial one that you're talking about, then we want it, the facial one in bulldogs, to a point that it creates all kinds of breathing problems and other problems for the animal. So where do you think some of the things with monsters that we've created in the past that are things that creatures that make no sense? I mean, there are creatures like werewolves, we talked about those, but where do you think people come up with these other things that are, you know, that they don't act or look like anything we know? Any guesses? This would be no real science here, but real, any guesses as to where that comes from? I'm thinking like a swamp monster.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, the human beings have a wonderful imagination. So whether there was a legitimate, animal or, you know, blurry vision that someone saw, you know, people believe that there's a monster living in Loch Ness, you know, the Loch Ness monster. So people invent these things all the time. We've never seen aliens per se, but we have a really neat picture of what they might look like in our minds because we have an endless imagination. Some of these things could be conjured up in dreams, and you know that the people might not be able to distinguish the dream world from reality. So these are just ways to take what we know and kind of bend it into some kind of bizarre unknown to induce fear that normally wouldn't be there. I think Frankenstein is a classic example of this. Mary Shelley was growing up in a time where scientists had just figured out, just, you know, about a decade or so before she was born, that human beings are not animated by a supernatural vital force. It's actually electricity. So Galvani was the researcher who made this breakthrough, and it became a sensation. There were public demonstrations, and they're gruesome. They're kind of horrific, but that's perfect for Halloween, isn't it? But Galvani's nephew, and again, this is before Netflix and television, they would do these public displays where they would take corpses and hold electrical rods to every orifice on that corpse and watch it reanimate in minor ways. You know, they throw out a punch, they might open an eye, their mouth might begin to move. And, you know, you get these thoughts of, you know, this is the corpse coming back to life. You get these other runaway examples of terror about the dead coming back to haunt the living, when in fact, it's just electricity initiating reactions in between our neuromuscular system, because that's how it really runs. Mary Shelley incorporated these sorts of elements into her story of Frankenstein. It was also partly inspired by the fact that scientists had just begun doing blood transfusions. And she took it one step further. If we can now store and transfuse blood into someone, what other body parts might we be able to do the same? Could we conceive an entire being made up of old body parts and then brought back to life by electricity.
Amazing. We're talking a lot about Halloween legends and myths and fear and being kind of scared by things and how humans can create certain things, but how we can also mess around with our genetic makeup of different animals and create different things as well. So this is a perfect example of the intersection between the art of storytelling and the science of the reality of behind what's going on. We'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about the science behind monster legends, including how actual life diseases or disorders may actually have spawned or fueled monster legends. And we've been talking a lot about different things. One of the things we keep going back to is a reoccurring theme of zombies. And Randy, I know you have a colleague that has done a lot of work on how that whole idea of what makes a zombie and all that. You want to talk a little more about what she does in her presentation and what she talks about?
Yeah, my colleague, Dr. Carrie Journey, a wonderful neurologist. She was a resident mate of mine at University of Pennsylvania. She gave a presentation at our national conference one time about zombies. And specifically, it was about what, you know, creates a zombie and what parts of the brain might be affected to create the behavior or the different kind of attitude, movement, that they exhibit. And then just going through a lot of the legends of what creates a zombie, because, you know, is a zombie actually alive or is it dead? Is it, you know, can they come back can you restore them? And I think that somewhat is dependent on what made the zombie. So in her presentation, you know, one of her main slides was all the different ways that zombies come about. So are they a result of chemicals? You know, a plant that breaks down and, you know, releases a chemical that then infects the brain and the tissue. The Return of the Living Dead, classic example, Night of the Living Dead, those are, you know, somewhat. Is it a part of a parasite? We've talked just recently about the ants, obviously, earlier in the segment, Bill did, you know, a parasite that takes over, fungal organism that takes over an ant. So an example potentially of a zombie there. Viruses and bacteria are very popular in movies to do that. You know, and that's very popular from the standpoint that it's, I think we can conceptualize how it's easily spread if it is that kind of organism. And then you've got your, you know, supernatural and spiritual type zombies. And then you've got abduction, alien zombies. So she kind of goes into all the different kinds of way they're created. But specifically, you know, back to the toxoplasma and the other stuff is that, you know, what part of the brain you affect could create the behavior that you're seeing in that zombie. So if you affect the part of the brain that's associated with speech, well, then that organism or whatever it is that's created the zombie, they become, you know, mute. They no longer can interact. They use grunts or something else to communicate. If it's a part of the brain that is associated with eating, so if you have, you know, excessive appetite or a hyperexive behavior, then it could be part of what's called the hypothalamus, a certain part of the brain that we see that. So what part of the brain you affect can certainly cause the, you know, clinical signs, as we would say, or in veterinary medicine, you know, and people too, what we do is called neuroanatomic localization, just fancy words to say these signs mean a problem in this location of the brain or nervous system. And then you think of whatever disease or something else, but you know, specifically related to zombies. If you analyze a movie or a book and a zombie was acting a certain way, you could say, ah, well, you know, they must have this part of their brain that's affected. So she had fun in that lecture where, you know, she would, you'd watch videos and see, you know, a zombie move and say, well, this part of the brain must be affected. You know, if they move slow, and, you know, they have some kind of problem in the substantia nigra or somewhere else in there. So.
Yeah. And I could imagine she probably treated awareness of pain. One of the things we associate with some zombies' behavior is they don't feel pain.
Right. And you can knock that out too for people. I have a doctor colleague I know who, she has a condition where she doesn't feel pain. Certain kinds of pain. But that's a very common genetic phenomena. It's often associated with some other aspects of, you know, not sweating and some other genetic aspects, but there are common phenomena that we see with people. And again, we tend to make stories. That's what we do. So you run across people who might not feel the pain. You can imagine someone in that scenario 200 years ago can do things that nobody else can because they don't feel pain and it doesn't bother them. And next thing you know, there's a legend of this person who can, you know, walk on, you know, glass or coals or other things. Certainly there's going to be serious side effects of doing those things among other things, but that, you know, they could get, you know, that kind of legend surrounding them.
Yeah. And I know, Bill, it's really interesting because a lot of these things with humans, they also become the, you know, we kind of also like, not only do we try to explain things we're afraid of, but we also kind of like these scary things, hence Halloween. I mean, we kind of like, you know, these stories that of horror and scary.
We do, and I'm all for it. I'm a huge fan. I love watching a great horror movie, and sometimes the cheesier the better. You like to pick it apart and see what might be real and what might not be. But it's a phenomenon that you're describing that's called benign masochism. Because even though we're watching something scary, we know that we're safe. Okay, it's on a screen, it's not real. So it's a great way to get in touch with these primordial feelings that were so critical during our ancestral time and throughout evolution. We get in touch with those emotions and it just, you know, it makes you feel more alive. And that's one of the most wonderful things about getting afraid, but knowing that you're safe at the same time.
Yeah, and we've just come through a place where we don't know we're safe with COVID and all the things that we're doing. And so I would think that some of the behaviors we see in people are in relation to how they're coping with that fear that's real at the moment that they have. So, you know, you can tell them that they need to be vaccinated or to wear a mask, but they are creating narratives to help them deal with their fear. And those narratives can take on their own life.
Yeah, denial can be a very potent way to avoid having to face a harsh reality. And unfortunately, it has catastrophic consequences. So I guess as the saying goes, it's best to face your fears than to tend to deny a real danger.
Right. And Randy, I would think in your area, because it's a specialty clinic, you do lots of emergency work and that kind of thing. You're dealing very much with the real fears of the human client that you have, who's bringing this animal. And I'm sure they have fears. Oh, it's going to be the worst one. And I know I've talked with you, and you've had a couple of times where somebody has actually talked to an animal psychic and come to you with that. So I know that must be really a part of it. How do you handle that when, as a neuroscientist, when you've got an animal that you kind of have vectored in on what's really going on, but you've got a human that kind of has this whole theory in their head?
Yeah, I mean, that's the difficulty. I think there's many facets of that. When we look in veterinary medicine, you know, veterinarians really like people too. And if you're a veterinarian and you don't like people and you just are in it for the, you know, the joy of helping animals, that'll take you so far. But I think that's a lot of the problem. Those people burn out because these are, you know, loved ones that, you know, people are bringing in. And you have to have both, because if you can't connect with the people and you can't interact with them or you can't understand them, then that's where I think the stressors can come into pretty heavily in veterinary medicine. And we see a lot of that. When we're serious and we're trying to get to the bottom of something, we, you know, are also trying to figure out what is concerning, you know, for the client that's bringing that animal in order to help us, because we're relying a lot on what they're saying. And in neurology, most of what I'm doing is presuming based on what they're observing. I'm asking the owner questions about their interpretation of if their dog is confused about going into a room that it's been into 100 times. They go into a part of house they never went into before. If they're hiding under the bed, well, then we got to ferret out why that is occurring. Is that something related to, you know, an abnormality, or is it just a, you know, random variation in behavior? So
yeah, or aging.
Yeah,
aging sure. Could cause something to be more. You know, Bill, I know you're at the IU School of Medicine and you're in the research end, but I know people in the medicine end, physicians and nurses, they face the same things that Randy's talking about, which is a lot of the information you get has to come from the patient. And, you know, at least to get you started down the path. You don't just go and, you know, do a scan of the whole body and before you let them talk. I mean, I would think that, you know, what they believe and how they come to you is different. Both of you are really amazing in that, particularly right now during COVID, both of you are really incredibly busy, involved. I know, Randy, veterinary medicine is really difficult right now, being able to treat everybody. We have so many more animals, and that's got to be stressful. And Bill, I know you're on the cusp of always trying to work towards something that potentially you wish you could find the answer to, so that you knew whether it was affecting humans in a negative way through your research. And I know that the stress is there. What are a couple of the ways, real quickly, that you both cope with that stress of your job?
Well, I mean, it certainly, I think the big thing for me are family and working out. I think those are my two releases. You know, coming home and interacting with my wife and kids, I think that it brings me back to a grounded reality for me about what the purpose is of why I'm around, why I'm doing what I'm doing. So I think that's, and to me, working out is that I can shut my mind off and just do whatever I'm doing for 30, 60 minutes once a day, and doing that. Those are my releases for the day. And we talk about this a lot at work, but, and we need to find more of it, but trying to find common comedy, something that we all can find and laugh about together. Right. I think that's something that we, you know, are trying to figure out at work, how we laugh more together, because that really brings us together, it seems.
Yeah, I adapt a lot of the Stoic philosopher principles when I get bogged down and stressed out. And a lot of that involves, you know, you just turn on the news. That's pretty big horror story in and of itself, most of the time. And no matter how bad your day is, you can usually find lives who have it much worse than you. And you get to appreciate very quickly how good you have it, and how much you might take for granted. So by staying grounded in that sense and being grateful for what you do have, and engaging in some mindfulness and exercise, I agree 100% with Randy on that. That's an outstanding stress reliever and helps you reconnect with nature, especially if you can do so outside. Those are all great ways to disconnect yourself from the stress, and then go enjoy a horror movie or a good comedy if that's not your thing. Getting into that escapism for a little while, I think, can be very therapeutic.
Yeah, so Halloween can be therapeutic. You heard it. I think both Randy and Bill for joining me
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.